The broadcast is now starting. All attendees are in listen-only mode.
It is a pleasure to introduce our next instructor based in Chicago. Phil Ordway is managing principal and portfolio manager of Anabatic Fund. Previously, Phil was a partner at Chicago Fundamental Investment Partners, where he was responsible for investments across the capital structure in various industries. Phil earned an MBA from Kellogg in 2007 and a BS in Education and Social Policy and Economics from Northwestern University in 2002. Phil now serves as an adjunct professor in the finance department. As many of you will know and appreciate, Phil has shared his insights and ideas with our members in the past, and I'd like to draw your attention to three pieces of wisdom that Phil has shared. One is a presentation on the U.S. airline industry. Another, my conversation with Phil on setting up his investment firm, which is part of the Zurich Project podcast, and also Phil's series of articles on human misjudgment. Those are just a few examples of many of the wonderful ideas Phil has shared. So on behalf of the MOI Global membership community, a warm welcome back to you, Phil. Please go ahead.
Great. Thanks, John. I appreciate you having me. I always look forward to this to start the year. So thanks for having me back. And this year, I thought I'd do something a little different. We're going to talk about kind of a topic and a bunch of companies as opposed to just one specific industry like I've done in the past. So we'll just dive right in. As long as this presentation loads. There we go. So here are the prior conferences. These are the ones that we've done at the beginning of the year, every year. I think it's only fair to review these. You can see the various ideas started going back to 2014 and how they've done. And I'm happy, I'll leave plenty of time at the end. I'm happy to take questions on these. I seem to always get lots of questions about the airlines. And they've been in the news as always recently, so I'm more than happy to talk about those or the banks or Armstrong or anything else on that list from prior years when we get toward the end. But today what I want to talk about is a topic near and dear to my heart, capital allocation and the role it plays with investor relations and overall corporate governance. And the reason this came up is actually somewhat interesting. One of the companies actually on that page I just showed, one of our biggest holdings, recently hosted a meeting for some of its investors, and while I was there, I was talking to the CEO, and he sort of asked for my impressions about some things. So we were having a nice conversation, and I gave him my usual sermon on this topic of capital allocation and investor relations and overall governance in that regard. And to my great surprise, he was so receptive to it, he asked me to come present to the board on it, which I regard as a great sign, because as most of you probably know and have experienced, it's just not a topic that seems to get as much attention at the CEO and board level as it should. And that's often through no fault of their own, as we'll talk about. It's just not their background, not their interest, not their area of expertise. But I'll show here today, I think, I hope, why that's such a mistake and why companies really do need to pay attention to it. And as a side note, as always, like, I don't enjoy presenting in an area where I think people are just going to go out and blindly take the information. I think it's really helpful to study it and learn about it on your own. And this is a special example of that, because I'm going to go through a lot of companies where I don't even have a particularly deep amount of knowledge about a lot of these companies. I'm just using these companies as particularly good or vivid examples of certain ideas and practices as they pertain to capital allocation or investor relations or overall corporate governance. So please just take them for what they're worth. These are not investment advice by any stretch of the imagination. So the basic idea I think here is that there are three things that all companies need that everybody would agree on. They need to take their capital and allocate it effectively. They need to have good shareholders. And by that, I mean the right kind of shareholders who are aligned with what they're trying to do so that there's a helpful, productive, symbiotic relationship there. And to get there, they need meaningful communication with their shareholders and with all of their stakeholders. And they're often viewed in isolation, these three things, I think, but maybe they're all actually related. And I can find, and we'll go through several dozen examples of companies who do it right when it comes to allocating capital and interacting with their investors. And if we can take that list and study that list, it should yield potential investment ideas for us over time. And especially for the companies, it's very important, because when they have the right shareholders, they're much, much stronger for it. I think anyone who's been in investing for any amount of time has seen how important these topics are. I mean, I think it's the highest and best use of your cash is the number one thing that any investor is doing, and it's the same with any company. The CEO and board will certainly have a massive influence on the company over any amount of time. If they're going to be there more than a few years, they're going to end up allocating a lot of the capital that's has been deployed in the company. And no matter how cheap the security, I mean, I've seen it, I'm sure most of you have seen it, a bad capital allocation decision, a regime, a bad acquisition, buybacks at the wrong price, just a poor overall governance environment can ruin any business. It doesn't really matter how cheap it is. It can go down the tubes very quickly if these things aren't done well. And rather than capital allocation, I'm going to use that term just because it's succinct and it's common. But really, it boils down to how we use our cash, right? I mean, this is a fundamental question, whether you're an investor or an executive within a company. And it's amazing to me how adept many companies have become at using their cash very intelligently. When it comes to managing their suppliers and vendors, and it comes to, you know, running their internal accounts receivable, when it comes to sort of the day-to-day operation of the company, when it comes to purchasing equipment and investing in their PP&E, they're incredibly smart in how they allocate their cash. When it comes to the financial aspects of their business, their capital structure, it tends to be a totally different conversation. And that seems very strange to me, because we're all just talking about trade-offs. Everything here is a trade-off. And again, I think as you go out and if you're talking to companies about this, you ought to be able to argue to them that this will define you as a CEO. This will define you as a company over any meaningful amount of time, and it will separate the good from the great, and it will take the good or the mediocre and potentially turn them into something much worse if it's not done well. And then secondarily, over time, companies will get the shareholders they deserve. If they're doing things wrong or doing things right, you know, that will eventually manifest itself in the shareholder list. Particularly, I think this is a key topic for this era, because there are some big things happening in the way corporate governance is executed, at least in the U.S., but that's for sure. The index funds are coming. They're here, and they're huge, and they're massive. They're often the biggest shareholders in any given company, and they have many benefits. I'm by no means discouraging index funds as a concept, and there's many, many benefits from the rise of Vanguard and others, but corporate governance is really not one of them. And in any company's life, if you're looking at a 5, 10, 20-year period, you're almost guaranteed you'll have at least one event where there will come a vote that's very, very close. And if all of your shareholders are passive or checked out, you're at the potential to lose your company to, you know, a somewhat arbitrary decision coming down essentially from ISS or Glass-Lewis or non-economic factors. And I don't think that's what anyone wants. Secondarily, the activists are coming, and this does have the attention of a lot of boards and companies. They're scared, and rightly so. And by the time the activists arrive, my argument is it's generally too late. The ship has sailed. And so the idea is to engage with your shareholders and have the right allocation, capital allocation environment to generate the right kind of shareholders so that you don't get to the point where the activists come. And secondarily, is there's just such a vanishing breed of long-term engaged shareholders, whether they're big institutions or sizable blocks of retail shareholders, they're shrinking, they're dying, and they're being replaced largely by the folks we talked about above, the index funds and some of the large pension funds. But that's really it. And so the holding period has declined rapidly, as we all know, and it's just sort of devolved into this unhealthy, unproductive shareholder environment that I think companies really need to pay attention to and try to fix. So capital allocation is a fluid process. The number one rule is that it's an ongoing process. There is no finish line. Conditions change. Your capital allocation decisions have to be adaptable. But a thoughtful framework is really all that's required. There are no hard and fast rules. There is no one size fits all. This is what I would refer to as a decision tree. I mean, that's kind of ridiculous. There's really nothing so fancy about this. I mean, you ought to have a pretty common sense list of priorities. That's all this attempts to do. And if you see a company that doesn't publish this, in my opinion, you should ask. And if they can't walk through this, and it doesn't have to look like this, it just has to look like something that makes sense given their business. And if you don't see this, that's a problem, and it needs to be addressed. Common traits, these are the things that I see most commonly at companies that have good capital allocation regimes and records and good corporate governance. Number one is just that they have an investing mindset. I'll talk in a minute about some of the CEOs that I think are particularly good at this. And what I think is interesting is the investing mindset doesn't mean that you used to run a hedge fund. that can certainly be helpful. But there are plenty of CEOs that had an investing background in some way, shape, or form. They were a venture capitalist, a real estate investor, a fund manager of any type, and then they somehow end up in the C-suite at a company. And that's great. There are also plenty of CEOs that have absolutely no background in it whatsoever. You know, they're lawyers, they're marketing executives, they're operations people, but they get it. Immediately when it's explained to them, they get it. And that investing mindset then permeates through the whole organization. And that's really what you're looking for. And it's amazing how many different places that can come from. And at least as important as what not to do, you know, first and foremost is to just pretend like it doesn't matter or deny that there's a problem. You see lots of individual practices that are particularly dumb, and you know, I won't read the laundry list here. We've all seen this, but you know, just eliminating these bad practices would be such a big step in the right direction if companies would embrace it. The things that I like to see in terms of overall corporate governance is a dedicated or best yet interdisciplinary capital allocation team at some level of the senior management. You know, we've talked about this in prior examples. I certainly do this with my own investments, doing what I call pre and post-mortem, looking in advance what can go wrong, and then at some point down the road, what actually happened, what worked, what didn't work. Companies that can establish that discipline internally are particularly effective. If you look at the board level, and this is what I'm going to be talking about next month with the company that I mentioned, you know, I would actually allocate or advocate for a capital allocation committee, and that's not to add one more layer of committee or bureaucracy at the board. It's just to highlight the fact that this is something that's really important. And there are actually shockingly few companies that I could find that actually do this or even mention it anywhere in their corporate governance documents, in their charters, in their bylaws. These are a few of the companies that I found by searching SEC filings, Edgar and CEDAR, and just doing simple Google searches. There were shockingly few that mentioned any sort of capital allocation committee as a function, even if it's just a sub-function of the finance committee. And I did a little survey. I took 50 of the Fortune 500 companies, and fewer than a third even had a finance committee. So again, you don't know what's happening in all of these board meetings. They're talking about finance issues. They're talking about capital allocation. But I think it would really send a powerful message and be effective if they made it much more of a priority. And then the second thing is just finding people to serve on the board, at least one or two people to serve on the board that actually have the capability and have the diversity of background to think this way, to think as an investor, to bring an independent board level view of capital allocation, to act as a check on the CEO and the management team, and to just make sure that the board has its own opinion. They certainly have their own opinions on other topics. Why wouldn't they have an in-house so-called expert to do this for capital allocation? I think that would make plenty of sense. Investor relations, again, this gets back into how you tie this all together. When you see most investor relations functions, in my opinion, it tends to be a dedicated function of the company that exists on its own. And it tends to be, you know, how do I interact with Wall Street sell side analysts in particular and keep them happy? And or how do I get the stock price as high as possible? And neither of those are productive in my opinion, and could be quite counterproductive in my opinion. So in my opinion, the investor relations function ought to be sort of an in-house but cross-functional role, some sort of role within the CFO or controller's organization, and not a permanent thing where one person does it forever, and make clear that what you're trying to do is communicate as needed, not just because you feel like you have to, because the calendar is on a certain day, because your peers are doing it. You know, provide the information you'd want if the roles were reversed and you were a significant shareholder. And I always prefer written communications. I think they're just more effective. And we'll go through some of these specific examples with some of the companies here later on. So these are a list of the exemplars. These are companies that I've found that I think are particularly good. Again, the point here is not that any of these companies are perfect. They're certainly not. Definitely the point here is not that these companies are perfect investments or even good investments. I mean, by no stretch of the imagination, by evaluating any of these on the basis of price and value and their investment merits, these are companies where I've found them to be, you know, in some way at least, you know, hopefully one or two or three notable ways, very well managed, very thoughtful, very effective in what they're trying to do. There is no ideal perfect company with perhaps one possible exception, of course, in Omaha. And that's actually one thing I wanted to bring up is one item of pushback I often get when I bring this sort of thing up with companies, as I'm talking to CEOs, talking to management teams, or even just other investors, is you either get sort of that visceral reaction to Buffett the persona, Buffett the personality, or you get the very reasonable response that I'm not Warren Buffett, I'm not running Berkshire Hathaway, I don't have their circumstances, so this stuff just doesn't apply to me. And that's fine, but my point is that there is no Warren Buffett. There's only one Warren Buffett. There is no other Warren Buffett. There is no other Berkshire Hathaway. You don't have to be that. What you have to try to do is make incremental process to a better state of the world, a better company, to try to improve yourself. And if you take some of these best practices that other companies have figured out who are not run by Warren Buffett, they're not Berkshire Hathaway, you can actually make a huge difference and make your company far more valuable over time. So I think one of the best examples of what I'm talking about is Constellation Software. For anyone who doesn't know, this is a Canadian-based company that's made dozens and dozens of acquisitions over the years in various vertically managed software companies. It's basically a pure software technology company. This is about as far as you could possibly get from Berkshire Hathaway and Warren Buffett, but the CEO, Mark Leonard, is enormously thoughtful in what he does, and look at the results that he's posted here. I mean, this is one investment. This company just IPO'd in 2006, not even that long ago. And this is the kind of investment that if you could identify it and find it early, which unfortunately I certainly did not, it could literally change your life and change your career. And I don't think it's any coincidence that capital allocation is at the very heart and core of this company. And Mark Leonard's a good example. He did have an investing background, more of a VC type background. But he gets it. He gets it very clearly. And if you look at what he's done, and look at where he's laid out things and how he's laid things out over the years, you'll see a very consistent framework, and that's what's most important. And this was obvious right in the prospectus when they filed to go public in 2006, as we'll see. But they are excellent, thoughtful shareholder letters. You should go through and read them. They're not even that long. They're just fantastic. They actually do written responses to investor questions. So instead of doing lots of sell-side conferences that take up a lot of time and lots of one-on-one meetings that are also very inefficient and somewhat unleveled in terms of a playing field, you submit questions, they take the questions that are meaningful and thoughtful and reply to them and file the responses so that everyone can read them. I mean, that's just the most obvious thing in the world to do, if you ask me. And here again, right here at the 2006 IPO, at the heart of our business model is the effective allocation of our capital. And if that's not a clear and impactful and meaningful mission statement, I don't know what is, and that really ought to be the case for every company, and of course it's not. They published case studies of things that they've done. They have this very effective board of directors, which we'll talk about in a minute. And they actually go about trying to intentionally develop capital allocators at each level of the company, which is something that I think is particularly unique. I'm not sure I've ever seen that in another company beyond perhaps Berkshire, where they try to nurture the capital allocation function amongst their other executives. This is a snapshot, I'll let you read that later, from the prospectus in 2006, just detailing what they do and why they do it. It's a thing of beauty. This is their capital allocation framework. And again, this is very specific to their software business. You can see that, but every company ought to have something that looks like this. And it doesn't have to look anything like this in terms of the details, but it ought to be this sort of framework and how they go about allocating their capital and what they do when they have cash available and what they do when they don't have opportunities, just as important. They tie their compensation plan to it, absolutely crucial. They make sure that people, you know, are tied to a return on capital, particularly, right? They're not just blowing capital out the door with no idea, no concept of an opportunity cost. And this is the board search criteria that I mentioned earlier. So here's a really interesting story. I actually, most of you, I'm sure, will be familiar with Larry Cunningham. He's the author of several fantastic books and compiled the original magnum opus, the Essays of Warren Buffett, with Warren Buffett's cooperation and approval. It's a fantastic collection. It should be on everyone's desk. And anyway, so Larry's kind of an expert, but he's a law professor by background and training. And this is what Constellation has is their board role search criteria. So they very intentionally go about trying to find board members like this. They don't view the board of directors as a country club for friends and cronies. They want it to add to the company's success, which I think puts them in the top, you know, 1% of all companies probably out there. And as part of this search process, they were actually looking forward and saying, you know, we'd like to find more people that understand you know, kind of corporate structure, culture, conglomerates, acquisition-hungry companies, and capital allocators. And Mark Leonard was, of course, familiar with Larry from his work and reached out to him directly. as a part of the search. They started talking, they did some work together, kind of on the side of some studies, and then and Larry's now on the board, which is just a fantastic example as to how this should work. And you know, listen to them talk, and you'll hear how much value the company has derived from that relationship alone. And that, in my opinion, is what every CEO and every board should be doing. Another great example that has nothing to do with what you might expect for capital allocation in the traditional sense is Texas Instruments. So I can't vouch for some of these specific details that I'll go into in a minute, but what everyone should take away is look through their investor relation materials, particularly those dedicated to capital allocation. They're absolutely fantastic. They have presentations, they have videos they put on YouTube to make it clear that not only is this important, you can see here this quote, again, I love, at Texas Instruments, we as managers think that allocation of capital is one of the most important jobs that we have. And again, that is as clear and important a statement as you'll ever see, and you almost never see it. And these are not guys that think of themselves as Berkshire Hathaway or Warren Buffett knockoffs by any stretch of the imagination, but they get it, and this is extremely important, and you'll see how effective it's been for them. The third part of this, which I think is maybe the most interesting, and again, this is somewhat anecdotal, but when they had a regime change with the new executives in particular, new CEO, new CFO over a period of years, this goes back some years now, they actually went out and actively reached out to investors that they thought were the right kind of investors. So I won't name names, but they went out to some people who I think we would all agree are fantastic, long-term, patient-oriented investors, and said, we think that you guys would be the right shareholders to own our stock. We'd like to sit down and talk with you. Think about, and it worked, of course, because it was so intelligent and so thoughtful, and the logic was there. The logic was on their side. And so they ended up getting several 2%, 3%, 4%, 5% shareholders that owned the company for years by actively seeking them out. Think about how much more intelligent that is than sitting there and doing conference calls and sell side presentations where you might just be yelling into the wind. You're certainly not targeting the right kinds of people. So this, going back to their capital management strategy, this is what they lay out as their strategy. They've got this business model. It's built around four things that they call their sustainable competitive advantage. And then they have the discipline to allocate the capital to the best opportunities, not because they feel like they have to or because someone's arguing for it. They have a strict, you know, hierarchy of these are the opportunities and these are how much each is going to get. It makes all the sense where they measure it. You can see here, these are the ways that they measure it. These are the targets they had. And then they actually publish the results. You know, here's what the target was. Here's what the result was. It's just fantastic. This is actually also important. As you look back, people don't really think in these terms probably, but over the preceding decade, they allocated $72 billion of capital. And if you'd have said in 2008, guys, we need to sit down and allocate $72 billion of capital over the next decade, that probably would have been a pretty sobering thought at the time. But it's true and it's important, and every company has some version of this to think about. And this is what they did and how they went about it, and you can see the results. Another great example is Morningstar. Here, there actually is somewhat of a Warren Buffett tie, as is often the case. Joe Mansueto, the founder, is a longtime admirer and friend and confidant of Warren Buffett's. So, but when they went public, they very intentionally structured their business to be decentralized, to have a long-term focus, to go out and seek the right kind of shareholders. They said, we're not going to take analyst meetings. We're not going to do financial. We're not going to issue any kind of financial guidance, which, again, I still can't fathom why that's as popular as it is. It just doesn't benefit anyone, really. And they have candid written IR communications as well, including published answers to investor questions, which we'll see in a minute. These are some of their kind of foundational statements as to how they run their business and how they strive to communicate with their shareholders. This is an example of what I talked about earlier. These are these Q&As that they publish where investors like you and me can write in and say, hey, you know, can you describe what you're doing here? I'm not quite sure I get this. How does this work, et cetera? And these are the answers that they publish for everyone to see. This is another one. Buybacks have slowed down over the years. Why? You know, is it related to your view of the stock price? That's a reasonable question, and they provide a reasonable answer. Another really interesting one is Graham Holdings, and this, of course, does have probably the most direct tie back to Buffett because he was a longtime shareholder and became a, you know, personal friend and mentor and tutor to the management team and the family. But look at what they've done over the years. You know, they've certainly been willing to reinvent themselves in a capital allocation framework by selling the previous crown jewels, spinning off, you know, what was the cash flow of the company, building a really deep and diverse and talented board, and willing to go much younger with their executive team and branch out into new industries. Again, one specific thing that has always kind of interested me is I feel like management teams get trapped into feeling like they have to be on the sell-side conference treadmill. Like, if I'm not there, if I don't have a presence, I'm going to lose out somehow. What if you just limited it to the ones that really make sense? So they do exactly one sell-side conference a year. They do a UBS conference in December every year. And that's perfectly effective. That's perfectly legitimate. I mean, there's not something to update at a conference every 90 days that requires so much executive time and attention. It's, an executive's most precious asset is their time. And so why wouldn't you want to be more careful in allocating your time to just the few things that matter? And doing that once a year or maybe twice a year seems like a very reasonable compromise. This is another really interesting example, Credit Acceptance Corp. And again, people are going to jump all over this based on the business model or whatever, and that's fine. That's not really the point. The point is how they go about using their capital allocation practices to benefit the company and to make the company more valuable over time. You can see here again, very clear statement that ought to be obvious, but it's rarely explicit and rarely executed upon. We use our excess capital to repurchase shares only when prices are at or below our estimate of intrinsic value. I mean, again, that should be obvious, but it's rarely said out loud. They acknowledge the fact that their assessment of their own capital position and their own valuation is subjective. It involves a high degree of judgment, which again is obviously true, but needs to be said out loud and be at the top of mind. And here's another really interesting part. They actually call out two of their board members. These are board members that have very deep investment experience. That's their full-time job. And they are the ones who are actually steering this at the board level. So here, what's so awesome is that the CEO is admitting that, look, I'm a great executive, or I think I'm a great executive. I'm running this company. But these two guys on our board are better investors than I am. So I'm going to defer to them in decisions where we may disagree about what to do with some of our capital allocation decisions, like repurchasing the stock. And how many CEOs have the self-awareness or the security to say this and do it? I mean, that is exceptional and really admirable, in my opinion. Another one, and actually with some board overlap here, one of those same board members is actually on the Cimpress board as well and is credited with often getting Robert Keane to see the light in terms of capital allocation. And Cimpress, as many of you probably know, is a very interesting company. They've done some really interesting things. And there, the CEO actually did not have an investment background, but he had that aha moment where, again, you always hear the inoculation of is when someone explains to you how capital allocation should work, you really ought to be able to get it in the first 2 minutes, because if you don't, you're probably never going to get it. And this is a great example of that, where the light bulb went off and the rest was history. And they do some really intelligent things here in terms of they track all of their investments. They track all of their repurchase activity. They have a document that covers their long-term incentive compensation plan that I think is particularly clear and admirable. They write an annual letter explicitly talking about capital allocation, which I think is fantastic as well. Amazon's probably one of the best-known companies in the world, but I think what's an underappreciated aspect of the company is actually their capital allocation and their investor relations and communications efforts. A company of their size now, that matters far less, but it certainly mattered back in the day. I mean, particularly after the dot-com implosion, when the company was in some bit of trouble and the stock was beaten up. I mean, the way they went about talking about their capital allocation framework, the way they went about cultivating the relationships with their shareholders absolutely mattered and was hugely important. And you can read this. I mean, this is a tech company, I guess. This is a classic, for the moment, disruptive company. But look at these statements. I mean, these ought to resonate with any of us, no matter how stodgy your views might be. I mean, this is exactly how companies should be run. Another good example is Phillips 66. At the far opposite end of the spectrum, sort of a commodity energy company. And look at this. We buy our shares when they trade below intrinsic value. We operate in a volatile industry, but we want to be resilient through industry cycles by strategically investing our capital in a way that adds value to our business and to our shareholders. As far as I can tell, that is unique among all of their energy company peers, and really makes them stand out, and they've done quite well because of it. This is an interesting thing, too. They actually published this. This is in their proxy statement. And you can see this is how they go about calculating their returns on capital. And it's a pretty thoughtful way that they've laid it out, which again, I've never seen in an energy company before. I mean, I've looked at plenty of energy companies, not so much recently, but in my prior life, and it's amazing to me how much return on capital gets completely ignored in that industry, particularly in E&P companies. This isn't an E&P company, but the way they go about doing this is uniquely thoughtful in the industry. Sherwin-Williams is another great example. They have this very clear and consistent capital allocation philosophy. There are some examples of this that I may not agree with, actually, and that's true with all these companies. I could probably find one or two aspects where I might not consider it perfectly ideal. In this case, they've taken this attitude that we will never hold cash, which I don't know. I mean, it wouldn't really bother me if a good company with a thoughtful capital allocation framework allowed cash to kind of pile up for a year or two. I mean, you don't want to hold, you know, an undue amount of cash for a decade, but they have a very strong view the other way. And that's fine because that fits their framework and their company and their culture and what they're trying to do. And you can see here how it's working. You know, one other thing that makes Sherwin-Williams really stand out, which is really impressive, is they were one of maybe a couple of dozen large public companies, at least in the US, they were actively buying back their shares in 2008, 2009. Everybody was buying back their shares in 2005 and 2006. But then when the stock, you know, pretty much every stock got hit hard during that period. And when a lot of them became very cheap, the buyers all disappeared. Even among the companies that had the capital structure and the excess cash and the cash flow to buy it, most of them just didn't have the courage, didn't have the framework like this in place to actually execute on it. But Sherwin-Williams did. And that's incredibly important and valuable, and they should be commended for it. It's another great example of a company actually that had the courage to do it in a contrarian way. And an example I want to call out, Jacques Esculier is a great capital allocator. He actually did this in September 2001 or 2011. You may remember there was kind of a scary period in that year. The Euro crisis was beginning to flare with Greece and some other countries. There was this pervasive fear that we were going to have a double dip and go right back into a nasty recession like the kind we'd just come out of. And the stocks, a lot of stocks, Wabco in particular, were being hit hard. So they actually had a dedicated special call. And again, this is not your every 90 days, I'm going to get on there and read the press release of the quarterly results. This was a dedicated call about a specific thing. Namely, we're going to go out and buy back a lot more stock, and we're going to tell you about what's going on to kind of address fears, concerns, misconceptions, just give you an update on reality as to how things are really going, because this is a pivotal time. And it was a pivotal time, and they bought back a lot of stock and obviously did very well on it. It was a very intelligent purchase at the time. Netflix, again, probably among the most analyzed or overanalyzed companies in the world. I don't have any strong opinions about the things that normally get debated about, but what I think is most interesting is how they've used capital spending, not in the sense of debt and equity or other securities, but they've used it as a competitive weapon to swamp their competitors. I think that's fascinating and one thing that's worth really studying and considering. And then one thing that really jumped out was their board practices. There's a link down at the bottom there to some articles and studies about what they've done it and how they've engaged their board. So they don't have a typical board by any stretch of the imagination. And some of the specific things they do in their board practices, I think, are really interesting. Rather than publishing some massive 100-page document for, you know, a board book for each meeting, they restrict communication to relatively short memos that directors can actually access and edit and comment on and amend over time. So you have more of a living document to mark your progress, to track your progress. I mean, just as I keep a running notebook of everything that I'm doing, everything I'm looking at, things that I'm thinking about, things I'm interested in, optimistic about, pessimistic about, investment decisions, and I use that to track my thinking and progress over time. They do the same thing with board level communications. And as far as I've found, that is extremely unique among all boards of directors. They also encourage the directors to actually get out and get involved with the company. So rather than go to some board retreat or go into some board room in a meeting in a sterile conference room and that's it, they actually encourage their directors to get out at least several times a year and go as an observer only. So they're not supposed to influence or interact with the meeting itself, but go to lower level staff and executive meetings and watch how the company actually operates in the wild. And I think that's an enormously intelligent practice. They've got some great investor relations documents and practices there as well. I mean, the IR website there and the effort and thoughtfulness they've put into their investor relations effort there is really impressive. Henry Schein's an interesting one, dental and healthcare products and distribution business. They've had some fantastic results in using a value-based approach to repurchasing shares, making acquisitions. They've done over 200 acquisitions in the last couple of decades. They've invested massively in organic growth and new product lines and new geographies. And this is one thing I think is really, really interesting that I also hear about, and it ties into this whole concept of investor relations and corporate governance, and that is that they don't let the tail wag the dog. They say very clearly and explicitly, this company does not exist for the investors. Now, the investors are important, and we acknowledge that we can't exist without them, of course, but we're not going to let things get out of order. And I was thinking about this a lot lately, too. We'll get to an example with Matt Rose at BNSF here in a minute, but Herb Kelleher at Southwest, who just passed away, unfortunately, was very clear about this as well. You have to have the right order of priorities. And for most companies, I mean, there's a reason why equity holders are the residual security in the capital structure. And if a company's being run properly, they ought to often be the residual consideration in that process as well. If you're not putting your employees and your people internally and then your customers ahead of your shareholders, something's probably out of order and probably going to go wrong. Daily Journal, for anyone who's not familiar, is an odd duck, but a fantastic example of capital allocation. They built up, and this goes back to my comment earlier about allowing cash to build, they built up a massive cash hoard over several years leading up to and going and including the financial crisis, actually. And then at one fell swoop in March of 2009, thankfully, Charlie Munger was at the helm, as he'd been for many, many years. Made a massive investment in a handful of high-quality financial assets that were at, you know, exceedingly cheap prices at the time, and they've held them ever since. They've never sold a share. It's been almost a decade now, and we all know how well that's done. But just that patience, that willing to invest, you know, let the cash build up and then pull the trigger right away. They've also been extremely patient and willing to invest and take a lot of pain and suffering in their digital transformation into more of a software company. You know, that's exactly the right way to behave, in my opinion. Post Holdings, this is another example, kind of not quite a case study. I mean, Bill Stiritz is still there and actively involved, but the way they go about this is really intelligent. They just had a call, actually, a couple of months ago, where they said, hey, we want to reach out to our shareholders and have a conversation. We're doing this convertible preferred offering, and here's why. And it's, these reasons are all very common sense. This makes all the sense in the world, but most often, you don't see that at all. You just see a press release or a filing or something. I think it really helps to go through and explain why you're doing something in common sense terms and language to your investors, and you just don't see that enough. Really good example here, AutoNation. Mike Jackson, the longtime CEO, he's retiring actually here soon, but he's been the CEO since 1999, and he's overseen repurchases of 85% of the shares over that time period, often at exceptional values because the industry is cyclical. And you see here, we actually take advantage of that. We use the choppiness of the used vehicle market in the US vehicle market to our advantage, and then from strength, repurchase our own stock. It's been an enormous home run largely because of that. And here's what I think is interesting. For many years, their lead independent director, he actually just resigned, was Mike Larson, who runs Bill Gates's family office. A fantastic investor. And you can see here, this is actually a quote, this interview I'd recommend down at the bottom there is a quote actually from Mike Jackson. So Mike Jackson was literally a car guy, right? I mean, he understood cars and dealerships and running that business very well, but he didn't understand capital allocation necessarily. And through, you know, dedicated practice and sort of the luck of having these two amazing investors, I mean, say what you will about Sears, you'd probably still rather have Eddie Lampert on your board compared to a lot of other people. And Eddie Lampert and Mike Larson actually then tutored him and taught him how to think about capital allocation. And the CEO saying, you know, I got a PhD in capital allocation from these investors who were 15, 16% of my stock each. So almost a third combined in two individuals that had board seats and stuck with the company for, I think, over a decade in both cases. I mean, that is enormously powerful on multiple levels. This is another fascinating example, BNSF. So this is an interview link at the bottom there. I'd highly recommend. Matt Rose is retiring, and he's looking back on his career and how things are going. And some of the things that he talks about here in the way they spend capital. And this gets back to where capital is not just, do I buy back stock or do I pay a dividend? Capital is, how do we invest at every level of the company? And this is where I think executives spend most of their time thinking they've gotten really, really good. And he points out an interesting example. Wall Street and the sell side analysts in particular are pressuring some of these railroads to spend as a percent of revenue. And he thinks that's nonsense. We don't spend capital as a percent of revenue. We spend it based on miles, ton miles they haul, because bridges don't wear out with revenue. They wear out with units and gross ton miles. And that makes all the sense in the world, but somehow that's apparently being lost in the financial community right now. He also talks about how a lot of companies, have adapted this capital light model, which for many industries and businesses is the right way to do it and is enormously powerful. He thinks it doesn't make sense here, and he thinks that every industry, every business can benefit from growth, which I think is a really interesting framework and the right way to put it. This is a couple interesting comments about the unwritten commitment they think they have to be good stewards of capital in their regulated environment. Most companies are not regulated anywhere near the level that the railroads are, but that's obviously a very interesting comment. I'll skip the rest of this and let you read it later. And then to sum it all back up, this is actually from a presentation that General Electric gave in November of 2017 with the then CEO, John Flannery. He actually made a very explicit push to put a new emphasis on capital allocation principles and priorities. He actually added a finance and capital allocation committee to the board, which I think is enormously commendable. He cut the size of the board, it was way too big. He opened up some more investor shareholder friendly things there. And I point this out just to say that it's not easy. I think he did all the right things in this regard. GE had been going a certain way for years. This wasn't enough to save it. So again, this points out that there is no one way, there's no one true path. You have to do a lot of things right. This is just one way to make some incremental improvements and something they tried to do. So this is tongue in cheek, but if you were to just create a new ETF of capital allocation all-stars, we didn't talk about some that I'm sure everybody's already familiar with that I would obviously include: John Malone's companies, Markel. I think we've talked about most of the others on this list, but anyway, if you were to create an ETF of capital allocation all-stars, that would be a pretty interesting idea. Again, this has no consideration to what sort of value you're getting and the price paid here, but it's a pretty interesting concept. These are some other interesting companies to consider that I didn't have time or wasn't quite familiar with or didn't think that they added anything that was distinct from what we already included, but these are great companies to also go out and consider and look at. So, and these are historical case studies. Again, I always see, I think The Outsiders is a fantastic book. Some of them are listed here. I get a little worried. Some people kind of overdose on that sometimes. You saw that most recently with some high-profile corporate disasters. But I'm always a big fan of studying what's worked and what hasn't worked in history. I mean, particularly if you go back into some of the old ones, and everybody talks about and looks at Buffett and Munger, but I think blue chip stamps and the way they allocated capital there. I mean, you could argue that without blue chip stamps, you would have never had See's Candy, and without having See's Candy, you would have never had a lot of the other things at Berkshire. At least you wouldn't have had it for years and years to come. So I think that's a fantastic one to go look at as well. So that's it. I've got recommended readings here in the back, and I think we'll just move to any questions, if there are any that John has or from the audience.
Well, Phil, thank you very much for another fascinating presentation. I would just encourage everyone to type your questions into the online interface if you have them for Phil. Phil, I'd be curious if you could elaborate on Amazon a little bit as a case study, because I think the company has been faulted by some investors for really not focusing on profits very much. Just if you could square that with their good capital allocation.
Sure. Yeah, I wouldn't want to hold myself out as an expert on Amazon, but the things that jump out to me are that they always had a framework in place that made a lot of sense, right? Which is that we're investing in the customer first and investing in our company to serve the customer first. So rather than take a dollar of margin today, I'd rather reinvest that dollar of margin and drive down prices and reinforce the whole company that way, rather than run it to maximize cash flow today. And look, I think it worked marvelously for them. I think what's dangerous about it is you see other companies where you end up in sort of a waiting for Godot situation where they all talk the right game of the deferred gratification by saying we're going to invest for today to make tomorrow stronger. That's fine. That's fantastic. It's just there has to be a tomorrow. And that's what I think is most interesting about Amazon, as you've seen over the past several years. largely through Amazon Web Services and a few other things, but that value was absolutely always there, and it absolutely worked. And so I think the capital allocation there internally was very intelligent. What I think is most important to note there is not that there wasn't profit. I mean, if you look back, and I actually didn't include this, but I could have, Costco, is just down the road and obviously shares a lot of commonalities with Amazon in ways that people may or may not think about. But certainly Amazon Prime very closely mimicked the Costco membership model for good reason. And that's what really, I think, allowed them to make a lot of the leaps that they did. But if you go back and look at Costco, when they IPO'd, I actually just went back through it. So they IPO'd in 1985 and their first annual report came out in early 1986. And it's an absolutely fantastic read. And it's actually back in the day when you could get a 25-page annual report that told you absolutely everything you needed to know. It's a great example of that. And I can point people to where it's available or send them a copy of it. It's a fantastic thing. But Costco wasn't profitable at the time. They weren't even close to profitable. They were growing like crazy. Memberships were doubling and tripling in a period of a year or two. And you could see that the business model, the framework was there. And they were talking about what they were doing and why they were doing it and executing on it. But the profits weren't there. And I was actually talking to somebody at the company not that long ago, and I found out that in the Midwest, the region that includes Chicago and all the surrounding states around here, they've been in the Midwest for over 20 years. But because they have a 5-year earn back on average for a store, and because they've been growing like crazy in the Midwest, I think they're up to 85 stores or 100 stores or something like that in this region out of the 700 or so they have total. Because they've been growing so quickly in this region over the last 20 years, the region as a whole actually just went profitable for the first time ever in 2018. So if you'd looked at that at the high level, you'd think like, this is a disaster, this is terrible capital allocation. But no, they were just playing a much different, longer game. And I think what matters is that they never changed the framework, they never changed the goalposts. They didn't try to distract people and say, we screwed up and let's focus on something else. It was always very consistent and logical. And it's not to say they didn't adapt and change course as they went. It's just, it's sort of like the Potter Stewart, I know it when I see it kind of test. So unfortunately, I guess I don't have a better answer on Amazon than that. But those are the things I would highlight.
I'll take a couple of questions from the queue here. What KPIs or metrics do you track to help assess capital allocation outcomes? At some point, it may not be enough to simply rely on anecdotal qualitative information from proxies and investor presentations.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So, I will at least at first pass be willing to accept what management is putting out there as the KPIs. If they don't publish any, that's kind of a concern. But I'll always have my own. I have my own, and I usually do it a couple of different ways, but I'm always tracking return on invested capital and then tracking return on invested capital that's incremental if you can do it. It's sometimes a little hard depending on the business, but I think that's really the single one to focus on is, you're taking a dollar, you're putting it out, what are you getting back for that dollar? And you can do that at a high level. It's even better to do that at a micro or a segment level if you can. Again, that can get a little tricky, but it just varies so much industry by industry. If I were looking at a bank, I'd want to look at, how many deposits per branch do you have? What's your efficiency ratio across the whole company? And, how has that changed over time? Certainly looking at return on assets and return on equity to see how it all rolls up together. But that sort of talks about the efficacy of really what you are as a bank is gathering deposits and then redeploying that capital into income and yield generating assets. So you want to get down to the deposit level for a bank. If you're looking at an airline, for example, you try to get down to the level of individual, plane and aircraft investments and maybe hub by hub. You can't really do that. If it's a legacy carrier, you can in some cases. You can get down into some granular data there and just say, what are the returns at these various levels of the company? And try to take it from that.
What sort of premium would you be willing to pay for good capital allocation? Maybe using Constellation Software as an example. A lot of the current valuation seems to assume continued future acquisitions at high returns on capital.
Yeah, it's a great question. And I don't think I have a great answer for it. I guess all I would say is that I would certainly place a value on it, and I would certainly say that my appreciation for it grows every year, every single day. So there is too high a price. There is too high a premium to place on it for sure. So I can't give any specific advice. I think it's dependent on your own specific views. I mean, if you wanted to take Constellation as an example, you'd have to evaluate both the business and the people involved and say, what do you think they're going to do? So I would simplistically try to learn as much as I possibly could about the business at a micro and operating level, and place it in the context of where do I think this business is going to be 2, 3, 5, 10 years from now, because I have no idea where it's going to be on a short-term basis. And over the long term, I mean, the range of error gets pretty wide, so you have to be pretty comfortable that the odds are in your favor there. And you just have to say, you know, what are the odds something goes really wrong here? What are the odds that something can go right? What's most likely in between? And say, you know, what's a common sense price to pay for this? And if I put in, you know, $100 of my own capital into this company today, what are the odds that I ever get it back? And then what are the odds that it provides a reasonable return as a second thought? But certainly, you know, I'd be, if you took two companies side by side, and this is one of my favorite things to do, I've done it here before last year, I think, with the airlines, I've done it with other companies, just take two companies side by side and start them at, you know, let's say 2010, coming out of the financial crisis. And even take two companies that are in the same general industry. So maybe take Phillips 66 and another refiner, or take a particularly good bank and another bank and put them side by side, but take their names off. So make it a blind comparison, and then say, you know, here are their financial characteristics. And you can ask people to value them then and say, what would you pay for this now? Or you can start with the valuation as a starting point, and then look over the next, let's say it's been 8 years now or something, what has happened and how they've allocated capital, because that's a meaningful amount of time, 8 years, and say, over that 8 years, here's what they've done, and then what's it worth at the end. And then when you do the big reveal and say, look at what's actually happened here, I think that's where it really becomes clear that it is worth some massive premium to what you could have paid a much higher price back in 2010 for a good capital allocator versus just an average one, and let alone a poor one. I mean, like I said, if you have that's probably the number one thing is don't even be too worried about the premium. I mean, you don't want to pay a crazy price by any stretch of the imagination, but just avoiding the bad ones, I think, is a huge step in the right direction.
Wonderful. Well, Phil, thank you so much for taking the time to be here and to deliver another incredibly interesting presentation. All the best for your presentation to the board. I'd be very curious to hear how that went. And thanks for showing your contact information here on the screen as well, so that our members can follow up with their own thoughts and questions.
Yeah, absolutely. And I meant to emphasize that earlier. So I'm sure that I'm missing plenty of examples here, and I'm sure that I've got some things wrong in here. That's one of the best things about these conferences. I always enjoy the feedback and the comments and the questions I get. So please don't hesitate with ideas, suggestions, corrections, all of the above. So, and thank you again for having me, John. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Goodbye for now.
Take care. Bye.